Welcome to Broken Law, brought to you by the American Constitution Society, a 501c3 nonprofit, nonpartisan organization. I'm Jeannie Hruska, Senior Advisor for Communications and Strategy at ACS. Over the past few weeks, we've been soliciting your questions about the upcoming Supreme Court term, which starts October 2nd. We're going to strive to answer your questions on this episode as we discuss the biggest cases and expectations for the new term. Joining me for this episode are my colleagues from our Department of Policy and Program, ACS Senior Director of Policy and Program, Lindsay Langholz, ACS Director of Policy and Program for Racial Justice, Tonga Leslie, and ACS Director of Policy and Program for Economic Justice, Beth Binchek. Team, welcome to Broken Law.
Hello, hello.
Thanks so much.
Happy to be here.
It is so much fun to have all of you on the same episode, especially because I have a feeling we're going to start out really excited to talk about the new term, and then we're all going to just be doomsayers by the end of the episode.
Misery loves company.
So at least we're starting with smiles on our faces. I'll start really broad for a question for all of you. As we all know, that so often the Supreme Court will take a batch of cases related to a single topic, and those batch of cases kind of come to define the term, right? If we think of last term, there were a series of cases about race and racial discrimination. There were a couple big cases about elections, and those really seem to dominate the narrative about the term. So looking ahead to the new term, what are those topics that you think are going to be really defining over the next year?
Well, for starters, there are three huge administrative law cases: Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo, CFPB versus Community Financial Services Association of America, and SEC versus Jarkissi or Jarkissi. I've heard it pronounced both ways. I'm interested to see how it's pronounced at oral argument. But those cases individually and certainly in combination could significantly reshape administrative law.
And can I just say how excited I am to have you here to break administrative law down, since I feel like that is one of the weedier areas of law. So it is wonderful to have an expert on.
Happy to be here. It can seem wonky, but it touches everyone's lives in so many ways. It's really important.
Another way that people's lives may change is whether or not a political official can block you on Twitter.
On X.
We've got a couple of cases. On X, but please forgive me. On X.
I can't believe I said that, but yes.
Very important branding. We've got a couple of cases coming up that have to do with the First Amendment, but particularly freedom of speech and the way that it interacts with political speech. And in two cases, how it interacts with that speech being online. The way in which people interact online, but particularly public officials, and whether or not they can block you or keep you from seeing the content that they're putting out there from official or official-looking pages. So that'll be really interesting to see.
That seems like a particularly almost dangerous topic when we're heading into the 2024 election cycle, and those decisions are going to presumably come down next spring, summer-ish.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, we've got in the background of all of this, a couple of different indictments going on where claims of freedom of speech and particularly political speech are being made. President Trump has allegedly, according to the indictments and our plain eyes that we all saw, has taken to social media many times to spread disinformation and also engage in what at least the DOJ is claiming were acts that were crimes. And so we're going to really get a sense of how that plays out in criminal court. But also at the Supreme Court, we're going to get a sense of kind of broader questions about what this looks like in terms of what's protected by the First Amendment and what's not.
Well, let's dive into admin law.
I'd love to.
And I'll just say at the top, we're going to have several episodes over the coming term that delves deeper into these cases, because there are a lot of technicalities. There's a lot of detail to it. But I cannot underscore enough what you said, Beth, that these cases really could reshape government as we know it, which would have a profound effect on our lives. So let's dive in. You mentioned that there are three cases this term. Can I just start by saying, what do you make of the court taking three? Should we read into that in any way?
I think it's hard not to read into that. You know, each of these cases raises distinct legal issues, but together they represent a continuation of an ongoing attack on the administrative state. And I'll back up now and explain what the administrative state is. So that refers to agencies in the executive branch that actually carry out a bulk of the work of governance. So although issues involving the administrative state can sound wonky and they're too frequently overlooked, they're incredibly important. I think Lisa Heinzerling, a professor of law at Georgetown University Law Center, put this really well when she said, "Anyone who eats food, drinks water, breathes air, drives a car, takes medicine, receives mail, collects retirement benefits, or owns publicly traded stock, to name just a tiny set of examples, has crossed paths, even if unwittingly, with the work of an administrative agency." So while people might not often think about the administrative state, it really has a profound effect on their everyday lives.
And we've already seen that this packed kind of conservative supermajority has an opinion about the administrative state. I think that's fair to say.
Yes, so we've certainly seen that in a number of ways, both, you know, judicial opinions that they've authored and, you know, separate writings when they're on or off the court.
Yeah, so several of these justices think the federal government needs to be reined in, to put it mildly.
Absolutely.
So one of the terms that there is going to be thrown around a lot this term is the Chevron doctrine. Many of our listeners may already be familiar with this, but for those who aren't, what is it and why is it at the center of these cases?
So the Chevron doctrine is a shorthand reference for the rule that courts are generally to defer to an agency's reasonable interpretation of a statute that it administers. This comes from a 1984 case called Chevron USA versus Natural Resources Defense Council. And that case set up a framework that courts use to review agencies' interpretations of statutes. So the Chevron framework has two steps. At step one, a court has to determine whether Congress directly addressed the precise issue at hand. If it did, the court follows the statute, we're done. If the statute is ambiguous, then the court moves on to step two. And at step two, the court must determine whether the agency's interpretation of the statute is reasonable. If the agency's interpretation is reasonable, the court defers to it. And Chevron rests on a few assumptions. These include that agencies have expertise in interpreting statutes that they're tasked with administering, that they're better positioned for policymaking as they're more politically accountable, and that statutory ambiguity indicates that Congress intended for the agencies to fill in these gaps and make these decisions.
Is it fair to say that, generally speaking, Chevron is deferential to federal agencies?
Yes. You know, when Congress legislates, they can't foresee every possible circumstance that happens. And so what often happens is Congress will assign, you know, rulemaking authority to a particular agency, and then the agency has the ability to fill in those gaps that Congress may have missed or not been able to foresee.
Yeah. If you stop for a minute and think of Congress trying to do the job of the SEC or the CDC or the FDA, nothing would ever happen.
It's exactly right. You know, Congress, you know, particularly now, is so prone to gridlock, and it just takes so much time for legislation to be passed, you know, if it even does get passed. So although agencies might not move as quickly as people always want them to, for a government actor, they are fairly nimble.
Yeah. So the question this term, right, the court's obviously revisiting Chevron. And the question is, what is it going to do? The expectation is that they're going to overturn it or shrink it down so it fits in your pocket?
Yeah, I can only assume that the court granted cert in Loeb or Bright because there's a desire, at least from some justices, to overrule or significantly limit Chevron. So the case expressly asked the Supreme Court to overrule Chevron. And, you know, this is a bedrock case in administrative law. And Jeannie, as you mentioned, the conservative justices have shown their disfavor of Chevron for some time. Justice Gorsuch, in particular, has been noted for his animosity toward the Chevron doctrine.
Yeah. So we're going to either get a scathing dissent or a really devastating decision.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, just in November of 2022, in a dissent from a denial of cert, Justice Gorsuch made his disdain for Chevron really clear. So he noted that the aggressive reading of Chevron has more or less fallen into a state of disuse. You know, the government rarely invokes it, and courts even more rarely rely upon it. Nonetheless, he urged, at this late hour, the whole project deserves a tombstone no one can miss. So I think we should expect some similar writing, whether it's in a majority or a dissent from him.
You hinted at this earlier, but I just want to reinforce it. If we end up next June where Chevron is either overturned or made into a fraction of itself, how are people going to feel the impact of that decision?
They're going to feel it profoundly. I mean, Chevron and the agency's ability to make rules that then receive deference is just so fundamental to the way that our federal government operates. So the exact effects, you know, are going to depend on whatever rule comes out of the court, but replacing it with a rule that gives less deference to agencies is going to have a huge impact. You know, I mentioned the case is from 1984. Chevron itself was decided in 1984. And so for almost 40 years, the legislature has been working with this backdrop of Chevron, legislating knowing that that's there to fill in the gaps. Overruling Chevron could cast doubt on current and future agency actions. It could invite litigants to challenge rules that have already been upheld under Chevron. You know, someone could argue that an agency's interpretation was only upheld because it was determined to be reasonable. And now if Chevron's overruled, the court should reject it and adopt, you know, what they're saying is a better reading of the rule. So I think there would just be a lot of uncertainty that would follow from that.
It sounds like there would at least be temporary chaos as agencies figured out what they could do. Congress tried to figure out what it could do, needed to do, what it feasibly can do politically. Yeah, it's hard to underestimate the impact of those cases.
I think that's exactly right. Really, the Loper-Bright case puts at stake the benefits of political accountability, national uniformity, predictability, and expertise that the Chevron doctrine has supported for almost four decades.
When those oral arguments come up and we start to move towards next spring, we will be getting into more detail because each of those cases really has details and nuance that we want to bring out. But thank you, Beth, for that kind of initial really scary forecast, but I think that's what we need to gear up for. Lindsay, turning to you, you mentioned that there are a few First Amendment cases on the docket this term. What should we know about those cases?
Those cases are part of kind of a crop of cases the court has taken up that deals not only with the freedom of speech provisions of the First Amendment, but also the way that we all talk on the internet, to each other, to government officials. It follows last year's docket, which had a couple of cases on it, including a case called Google versus Gonzalez, which I know we've talked about on this podcast before, I think a couple of times, and the sister case to that that involved Twitter. It also, the court last term looked at a case called Counterman versus Colorado, which looked at the ways in which harassment would possibly cross into a true threat in terms of online speech that was presented in that particular case. And so we're really seeing the court try and grapple with the modern way that we communicate and the way that our elected officials communicate with us at a time that technology is changing rapidly. And this court is not particularly adept at talking about these issues sometimes.
They're also not technology experts, which like they've admitted.
Well, I was going to say, you know, Justice Kagan explicitly said during oral argument last term in the Google case, like, listen, we are not the nine people who know the most about how this all works. You know, maybe one or two of them have a shadow TikTok account. I don't know, but they are not particularly conversant when it comes to the way in which social media in particular is used and the ways that speech is used. I think that there's still some kind of classical thinking in terms of like the public forum and the way in which people in the society just talk to each other with a real blind spot for disinformation, misinformation. And so what we're seeing this term is grappling with whether or not a public official can keep you from seeing their messaging, especially if it's being presented as, you know, public speech or I'm sorry, political speech in their official capacities.
If they can block you.
If they can block you, right? We've got two different cases where we had elected officials at the local level who blocked folks. And it's an unusual set of alliances, unless you're particularly steeped in the free speech world. So you've got folks like the ACLU who are kind of free speech purists who are like, mm-hmm. Absolutely not. You should be able to say whatever you want to say to these elected officials. And then you've got folks on the other side who are like, we're being harassed. And we know that online harassment targets women, people of color, folks in marginalized identities across the board more heavily. And so there is a real need from some folks being expressed that they need to protect their space. And that includes their online space.
Is this thinking about doxing of like there needs to be a way to counter that kind of online assault almost?
You know, it raises all these questions, right? And so what we're seeing is like, what does the First Amendment have to say?
My dogs feel very passionate about this issue.
We are not going to keep them from speaking.
We won't block them. We promise.
I can commit to you. never going to block a pup. It's just, there's a ton of questions that just really the court is in an uncomfortable place to answer because it is First Amendment implicated, absolutely. But it's also just technology that they're not particularly well-versed on. And so it kind of fits a trend of a number of cases we're going to see from this court trying to wrestle with it. And last term, they took a real hard pass. They kind of got into the middle of Section 230 liability, which is the liability for social media platforms, and said, you know what, we're going to kick this can down the road a bit. And we're going to see what they have the inclination to engage with.
It's interesting because if we think back to kind of the old world of publishing, there are some really defining Supreme Court cases that address publishing as an industry. And now we're in this online era. And as you've noted, the court has yet to provide those same landmark cases when it comes to the First Amendment online.
I think that's right. And, you know, the case that I haven't mentioned, because it's not technically on the docket yet, but it is lingering in the back of all of this, is a case that's arisen out of the Fifth Circuit.
Wait, out of what circuit?
The Fifth Circuit, which you're going to hear me say a few times on this podcast.
You're shocked, right?
I'm shocked that the most conservative circuit in the country is producing Supreme Court cases.
Well, right now, you know, there's a race to the bottom at moments. But yeah, there's a case that arose out of Texas, in particular, is the law that basically says, like, social media platforms can't moderate in any way, like, pure speech, let's go, no rules. And so this issue is definitely not going away. It feels like it's kind of hovering over here to the side. I think everyone's pretty much expecting the court to take it up. And so we're really going to get to see what the court thinks in terms of both social media platforms in general, but also these public figures and how they interact on these platforms.
Talking to Beth, we talked about, you know, do you think the court intentionally took a slew of cases of like this, we want to address this? And it seems like you said, the court took a pass on Section 230. Very clearly, we're like, nope, we're not equipped to handle this right now. But now this seems like an intentional effort to say, okay, but we need to address this.
Yeah, I also think that it's just kind of an issue that was probably bound to bubble up to the court. You know, this technology has now been around for a few years, and you're also seeing a lot of disruption in this space, particularly on the platform side. You're seeing moderation rules change. You're seeing a lot of pressure from both sides on these platforms to either, you know, really restrict what can be said or let the floodgates open. And so heading into a presidential election where I think we're going to see that in spades, it doesn't surprise me that the court is taking up a number to try and kind of parse it all out the best they can.
In on admin law, I appreciate what Beth said of like, we know exactly how Justice Gorsuch feels about certain parts of admin law. He has been very explicit about that. Is there any tea leaves to be gleaned about how certain justices feel about these issues?
This one's a little harder. I'm really going to be looking forward to the oral arguments just to kind of hear in particular the questions that they're asking and trying to suss out the kind of nuances that are going on. You know, the Counterman versus Colorado case ended up 7-2 with Justice Kagan writing for a mix of folks from both sides of the political, or I'm sorry, the ideological spectrum. And it could go either way. There may be people who feel much more confident about how they think it's going to shake out, but I, for one, I'm not sure. I'm curious to see kind of how this lands.
It would be a breath of fresh air to have cases where you kind of get an odd combination of justices. It's nice to not be able to go into and be like, we know exactly how this is going to come out, because that feels so often the case these days.
Yeah, for sure. Keeps us on our toes.
You're listening to Broken Law, brought to you by the American Constitution Society. If you're enjoying Broken Law, consider becoming a member of ACS today. You do not need to be a lawyer to be a member. As we discuss so often on this podcast, our laws and legal systems impact all of us. By supporting ACS, you support Broken Law, our work to diversify the federal bench, and our advocacy for Supreme Court reform. You also become a member of our nationwide network. Learn more about ACS by visiting our website at acslaw.org. And now back to the conversation. So those are two big buckets of cases that, again, we're going to be getting into in more detail. Putting those aside, there are a couple big solo cases where, you know, it's one case, but it's a really, really impactful case. And I'm going to start with you, Tonga, on the Second Amendment, because this is a case that's getting a lot of attention and is very frightening in terms of how this could come out. So what is the Second Amendment case this term?
Yes. And I wish I had like exciting nuance, but this one is like, will it be bad or worse? The case coming up this term on the Second Amendment is United States versus Rahimi. And that is a case looking at the scope of the government's ability to regulate firearms. And this is an interesting area because we really see originalism on full display. There's many other areas where the precedent is more developed and it's more nuanced, but Clarence Thomas has largely led the charge on the Second Amendment. In 2008, an individual right to bear arms was announced, followed up, reiterated against the states in 2010. And then in 2022, there was a case called Bruin, where he specified, in addition to there being this individual right, the government's ability to regulate it must be within the quote unquote historical tradition of this country. And now that's finally being really put to the test. In some of those earlier cases mentioned, it would be in dicta or in passing that this right does not disrupt long held regulations. And actually, after those first two cases came down, some of the more extreme, not extreme for most of our listeners, but some of the stronger gun control measures that would have completely disarmed large classes of people fell, but most were upheld. But now looking to Bruin's test, it's really encouraging judges across the country to dust off those dusty history tomes and decide now what our ability to regulate guns is really based on understandings between 1791 and 1868. And you see these sprawling historical inquiries that those who are trying to uphold the regulations will have to look to. But it's kind of it's a how much will we lose position to be in, because, you know, everybody on this call would not have been considered part of the people in the era I described. And so the Bruin case does talk about trying to find historical analogy to make the bridge to the past, but it's really hard to make that bridge when cases like this one come up. And to give context on the facts on this case, it involved a man who pretty brutally assaulted his intimate partner. And then when a witness saw that assault occurring, he fired a gun after them. So his surviving partner filed for a civil protective order against him. There was a hearing. He had the ability to defend himself at the hearing. They found against him. She had a DV protective order. And under those orders, you aren't allowed to obtain certain types of firearms. And so when he then was brought up on gun charges for having guns in violation of this order, he challenged this whole law is unconstitutional because civil protective orders didn't exist during the founding era. Domestic violence was not a public concern during the founding era. And if you look just on the books, you won't find civil protective orders disarming folks in 1791 and 1868. And we've kind of are looking at the court like, is this really the test? This is the opportunity for the court to either moderate itself or to go, you know, full speed ahead. And that could spell huge upheaval for what we think about in terms of gun rights.
Yeah, I mean, I think every state has laws about when you lose the right to own a gun, when you're either prosecuted and convicted of felonies, or even when you're charged with a felony. I mean, there's dozens of these laws on the books, and this seems to be a direct threat to all of those, to basically to any state's ability to remove firearms from somebody's possession.
Well, the one nuance with this protective order is it's technically civil. And so the opinions in the past have said you're allowed to disarm classes of felons or mentally ill folks. But it does raise a lot of questions because the definition of what was a felony charge in the 1790s was much more narrow and limited than what's considered that now. And it goes to all sorts of things like, you know, background checks, things like red flag laws. A red flag law is not necessarily a conviction against somebody, but it is certainly something that you might be able to get a civil order. Like, this is a dangerous situation that you want to look into. And if we're really saying that things like that aren't allowed, it would certainly raise a lot of upheaval for even some of the quote unquote common sense gun measures that have, you know, 65% that we're already struggling to pass sometimes. Some things like red flag laws were in the last piece of gun legislation that Biden passed, which was the first piece of gun legislation in about 30 years. So it would really undercut any serious attempts to deal with the gun crisis we have in this country.
The red flag law is what first came to mind. Like, this seems indirectly like a direct aim at those which have gained popularity in recent years, maybe because it's one of the few things that folks thought could fit through the Bruin test.
We're definitely seeing them reaping what's a longer term strategy. No surprise that this is out of the Fifth Circuit. And certainly something to think about, like, how much do we want our hands to be tied? It's also interesting to look at what kinds of analogies are allowed, because even back then there were things called surety bonds, where if you suspected that your neighbor, you had a dispute with them and you suspected that they were trying to kill you or do you harm, you're still both might men in this scenario, but you could have it so that they were required to post a surety bond. And what's wild is seeing that when the federal government puts forth that evidence, it's either brushed to the side or it said this is only a few states or they weren't common. So there's one thing about originalism we're seeing is just because you have history, even in a difficult case like this, doesn't mean necessarily you'll win, right? Like, the judge has to decide what they feel about that history. Is that enough history? Is that the right kind of history? And so it really puts folks in a bind, even when they're trying to play into the rules as the Supreme Court has set them.
The one thing we know about originalism is it cherry picks the history it wants and fills in the gaps when there are any question marks.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. This is an interesting challenge to originalism, like you said, because if you take originalism at its word and you take Justice Thomas at his most strongest opinion about what originalism is, you're going to end up with a decision that says you cannot take guns away.
Yeah.
And so this is going to be an interesting challenge to see if the court walks back its strongest originalist tendencies.
I think there will be a lot of pressure, I think, on the other members of the court. I think
to not go that far.
Probably, as Judge Thomason is the one to write the decision, it probably would go to that extent.
But there are some folks, as we saw last summer, although they were hardly victories, but, you know, the Chief Justice wanting to sort of moderate the rate with which law is rapidly changing. So we'll see how the decision comes out.
Yeah, if that trend continues, this would definitely be a candidate for, like, as you said, quote unquote,
yes,
moderation.
What counts as moderation?
We're continuing to move. We're continuing to deteriorate. It's just a question of at what pace. We will definitely be covering that case in more detail, including the ramifications of it when the decision comes down next year. One other case that I wanted to make sure we covered is the case this year about gender discrimination in employment. Beth, what should we know about that case?
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about Muldrow versus City of St. Louis, Missouri, because I'm actually cautiously optimistic about this one. It frightens me to say that. I don't want to get ahead of myself.
We need at least one cautiously optimistic note on this episode.
I can't go full optimism, but I will go cautious optimism here. So, by way of background, Muldrow was a sergeant with the St. Louis Police Department from 2008 to 2017. She was assigned to the intelligence division, where she worked on normal business hours, Monday to Friday. She was in police headquarters. She's assigned important investigations and received a work vehicle. In 2017, she was transferred. She moved from the intelligence division to the 5th district. That was considered a lateral transfer by the city. So after the transfer, her pay remained the same, but her place of work changed. She was required to work a rotating schedule with few weekends off. Muldrow asserted that her work in the 5th district involved more entry-level police work, and she was required to return that work vehicle. So she sued and alleged that she was transferred to the 5th district because of her sex, and that she was denied a transfer to another position that she actually wanted, both in violation of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. The 8th Circuit determined that Muldrow's claims failed because she didn't show an adverse employment action. So a plaintiff who brings a claim for disparate treatment under Title VII in the 8th Circuit not only needs to show that she was subject to discrimination, but that she also suffered that adverse employment action, which the 8th Circuit defines as a tangible change in working conditions that produces a material disadvantage. So this could include things like changes in pay and benefits or rank, but it does not include quote-unquote minor changes in duties or working conditions, even unpalatable or unwelcome ones that cause no materially significant disadvantage. So really, this case asks the Supreme Court to decide whether a plaintiff must show that a discriminatory transfer decision caused a significant disadvantage, or if that discriminatory transfer decision alone constitutes a violation of Title VII. And the reason I'm cautiously optimistic is that I think Muldrow has a pretty good textual argument. So Title VII's text says, it shall be an unlawful employment practice for an employer to fail or refuse to hire or to discharge any individual, or, and I think this is key, otherwise to discriminate against any individual respect to his compensation, terms, conditions, or privileges of employment because of such individual's race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. So the text doesn't say anything about a significant disadvantage. It talks about it being a violation of Title VII just to discriminate with respect to terms and conditions and privileges of employment based on someone's sex. So I don't know what the court will do, but I think there's a chance they'll stay true to the statute's text.
I like that. And it's, again, kind of going back to Tonga's case, this, you know, we know this court loves originalism and textualism. So it'll be interesting to see how loyal the court is to those interpretations when it comes up against these factual patterns.
Yeah, that's really the heart of the question here is, are they going to stay true to the text or are they going to find a way to deviate?
Which they have readily done in the past when it suits them. So, but for the moment, I'm going to embrace your optimism and say they're going to use their tried and true playbook and stick to textualism. And we're going to get at least one positive outcome this upcoming term.
Here's hoping.
I like that. Lindsay, can we keep hoping?
Sure.
Two more cases that I want to touch upon. One is another big redistricting case. And redistricting continues to be a really big headline issue, not only because we're heading towards such a monumental election, but because even when the Supreme Court hands down a decision, it doesn't necessarily mean that a case is over, as we are currently seeing in Alabama.
Ooh, yeah.
So what is this, the newest redistricting case that's coming up?
So the newest redistricting case coming up comes out of South Carolina. And the facts are remarkably similar to what we saw in last year's case out of Alabama that you referenced, Allen versus Milligan. We saw a conservative state legislature decide we're going to pack and crack these districts to make sure that only one district has a meaningful opportunity to elect a member of color, particularly the Black community is the community that has been packed and cracked when we're talking about the district in question down in South Carolina. It is remarkably similar in facts and also in terms of what the lower court decided. The lower court looked at it and said, this is an impermissible racial gerrymander. We're going to strike this map down. And the state appealed to the Supreme Court. That's not unusual. These cases that deal with redistricting go through a little bit of a different path They start at a 3-judge panel, and then they immediately appeal up to the Supreme Court. That's just kind of the structure that's in place for these types of cases. So we saw that district court say this is an impermissible racial gerrymander, and the state run to the court. And the question that they've put directly in the court's lap is, what is a racial gerrymander versus a partisan gerrymander? We saw in 2019, the court say, we're not going to get into the partisan gerrymandering questions. We're going to leave that to everybody else. That's not our business. Essentially green lighting the practice of partisan gerrymandering. And so we've seen after this most recent election, the first census that was conducted after that Rucho decision, a number of conservative state legislatures, particularly in the South, say, no, we're not racial gerrymandering. It's partisan. It's fine. You said it's fine. This is all partisan, not a problem. But that lower court out of South Carolina disagreed and said, this is a racial gerrymandering case. It is impermissible racial gerrymander. And so now the Supreme Court is taking up that particular question. I think the cautious hope here for those of us who keep a close eye on the Supreme Court's docket is that, as you alluded to, the court just sent back down to Alabama an order that said, seriously, you have to follow Allen versus Milligan. Like, we're not joking. There's also a little bit of cause for concern. We saw in the concurrence in Milligan, Justice Kavanaugh express an openness to maybe sunsetting some of these protections for that are found under the Voting Rights Act that deal with particularly race. And in a number of ways, last term, he opened the door to these further questions about whether or not race should be discussed in various contexts. And that was certainly one. Having said that, they literally were recording on the 26th. They literally today just sent it back to Alabama and said, no, really, you've got to fix this. So there is genuine cause for hope. And I also want to, in particular, lift up the teams that have been litigating these cases. There's a number of them in the South. LDF has been on the front lines, ACLU, other groups. These are incredibly fact-intensive cases. They deal with computer models and statisticians and having to develop just a huge factual record for the courts to grapple with. So we'll see that again when it gets back up to the court and they hear argument in October. The court will have an extensive factual record to look at once again. But that is a credit to the litigators who've been really pressing this issue.
Can I just ask, given that Allen versus Milligan was decided a few months ago, why you think the court is taking up another case that seems so similar?
It's similar and yet somehow just like kind of slightly different in terms of the arguments that the court wants to entertain. And so really at the heart of Allen versus Milligan is Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act constitutional? That is a question that squarely looks at whether or not you can engage in the question of can you racial gerrymander versus not. This one's trying to parse out, okay, so we've affirmed you can't racial gerrymander. We've also recently said that we're going to throw our hands up on partisan gerrymandering.
But you can partisanly gerrymander.
Right. And so honestly, the court has created this problem for themselves. You know, it's trying to tease out, okay, what is actual partisan gerrymandering, which for the record is still terrible. And I don't want to go without noting that. But what is in that bucket that the court has said they're not going to look at? And what is fig leaf? You know, like, what are they just kind of hiding behind and saying this is partisan gerrymandering? The court here in the Alexander case said, we think it's a fig leaf and we think that you are impermissibly engaging with this. So it's kind of a mess they've created for themselves, although we were glad with the results in Milligan and it upheld a number of cases that were important. The courts backed themselves into a corner.
Well, it also seems like that this case, if it gets decided that, yes, indeed, racial gerrymandering is just partisan gerrymandering under another name, that it would neuter Allen versus Milligan.
Because then it
doesn't
matter,
because all of it is just partisan gerrymandering anyway.
It definitely has the potential. I think it's why a number of us after last term were like, listen, guys, we're not dancing in the streets on some of these decisions because the door's not closed. And this is one of those instances where we're hopeful. We're hopeful just because of the recency of how much they've been affirming the case. But we said that, and I'm going to say now, John Roberts is no fan of the Voting Rights Act, voting rights in general. He has made it a point of his career on the bench to go after these protections. And I'm hopeful, but, you know, I also think that that's a very real possibility that they come back and say, yeah, well, we told y'all it was hard to litigate a Section 2 case successfully. And here, look, we're going to prove it. It's a very real chance.
And again, a case that could impact the 2024 election.
Absolutely.
With a decision mere months before the election happens.
Absolutely. And, you know, we're going to keep going with this, right? They've created this mess. My dad would call it a goat rodeo. And it's not going away, right? There's cases in Louisiana. There's cases all throughout the country that are trying to figure out how to make sense of all of this.
We will continue to talk redistricting again. The decision on Alabama just came out today. Like, this is going to continue to play out. So listeners, stay tuned for more coverage on that, again, as we look ahead to next year's election as well. But Lindsay, I can't have you on without talking about the Mifepristone case, which is still out there.
Yeah.
What's the latest on that?
The latest is that the Biden administration and at least one of the drug manufacturers of the time of this recording has asked the Supreme Court to look at the Fifth Circuit's decision.
Fifth Circuit keeps coming up.
I know. Well, and I'm going to draw a particular line here. You know, I'm sure we'll get to trends at the end of this, but like not just the Fifth Circuit, but also one specific judge in Texas who is creating quite a bit of the problems that are coming out of the Fifth Circuit, giving them a lot to look at. But yeah, they have asked basically what happened at the Fifth Circuit. For those who haven't listened to the past episodes, there were a couple different ways the circuit could have gone. And the way that the Fifth Circuit chose to go is to say, we think it's too far in the past to look at the original decision from the FDA to allow Mifepristone to go on the shelves. However, we think it's still fair game to look at some of the amendments they made in 2016 that really opened up access, ease of access in particular, to Mifepristone. And as a reminder, Mifi is one of two drugs in a cocktail that is most commonly used in medication abortion in the United States. It is currently still accessible anywhere that you could possibly have done so before. Everything is on hold while the courts sort this out, so I don't want to create any uncertainty there. But should the Supreme Court decide to agree with the Fifth Circuit, they basically would say, fine, Mifi can be on the shelves, but there's more onerous restrictions if you want to get it. I think what's particularly important to highlight here is the FDA decided to put in these amendments. The scientists who worked there said, based on medical developments.
Harkening back to Beth's discussion about deference to federal agencies.
100%, here we go. This is an agency decision that was made years ago in a case where the people bringing the claims are like, we would prefer that people don't have access to this drug. That's our standing. We might end up treating one of these patients at some point that has a bad reaction.
But for the record, it's been used by millions of people.
It's safer than Tylenol.
Incredibly safe.
Absolutely. Yeah. It is used widely and is used safely. And this is truly an ideological fight that is taking place in our courts that was unleashed by the decision in Dobbs. And what we could see if worst case scenario, if the court decides Judge Kaczmarek is our guy, we could see Mifepristone pulled off the shelves across the country. And so, you know, when Dobbs came down, I think a lot of folks were screaming into megaphones, listen, this is not an issue that's only going to affect folks in red states or in abortion ban states, however you want to think of kind of the divide of access in this country right now. The anti-abortion folks are not going to be satisfied until there is a nationwide ban and they are willing to use whatever tool they have. So keep your eye on this one. The Fifth Circuit's opinion is the one on the table for the court to primarily look at, but it could go a number of different directions and we're all holding our breath a bit.
And just to be clear on the status, so the Supreme Court put a hold on the Fifth Circuit decision.
Yes.
Has the Supreme Court taken up the case for full briefing?
They have not yet, but it is expected. I shouldn't say expected. I think that if you were to ask me to put odds, I think that it is likely that it is taken up. Again, the court has made its own way on abortion laws. They took to the shadow docket to uphold SB8. So who knows at the end of the day, all this is kind of tea leaf reading. But I think given both the importance on the uncertainty and honestly, the just shoddy record that the decision is based upon, I am hopeful that they take it up, and I'm hopeful that they take it up with a seriousness and a deference to the medical professionals who put these rules in place.
Well, that may be an indication of how Beth's cases turn out.
Yeah.
So there's so many interconnected patterns across these cases.
For sure. I should also highlight that this is pending right now on the docket. We'll see what the court does. Going into an election year, and we have seen across the country, abortion is on voters' minds. And so it will be interesting to see how the court reacts to the backlash, the political backlash that resulted out of Dobbs, and what they decide to do with this case. So it may be that they decide to step away from having to get involved, but unclear so far.
So a lot of concern heading into this term, a couple moments of cautious optimism. Beyond the cases that we've discussed, what are each of you looking for, expecting? How are you thinking about this term?
I'll go ahead and dive in. One of the things that I'm going to be paying attention to is how the court goes about defining the judicial role. So last term, many criticized the court for expanding its own power. I'll be interested to see whether the court continues to expand its authority, whether that's by, you know, ignoring statutory text in cases like Muldrow, or, you know, peeling apart the administrative state one case at a time. I'll really be just kind of keeping eyes on how each of the decisions kind of weaves into that story.
It is interesting how the court really seems to hate unelected bureaucrats, but seems to really believe in the awesome power of 9 unelected justices. Really, like 5 unelected justices.
On the topic of elections, I'll go next and just say one of the things that we haven't talked about because it just hasn't come up yet are all the cases that will inevitably arise out of the upcoming presidential election. There'll be hotly contested primaries in the spring, and then obviously the general going to next fall. But with every election cycle comes states trying to put in place rules, states trying to figure out kind of new ways to either enfranchise or disenfranchise their citizens from participating in the electoral process. So I will really be keeping an eye on not only the cases that haven't been taken up because they haven't arisen yet, but also the ways in which the cases political, or particularly the political speech cases, but also the Miffy case and the redistricting cases, frankly, to look at the ways in which these cases interact with the election cycle that's coming up. We've seen members of this court be much more loose-lipped in terms of how they think people are perceiving the court and how that's impacting the way in which we interact with our democracy. And so it's really going to be interesting to see if that spills into any of these arguments, if it spills into any of these opinions, and how the court reacts to the amount of pressure that they've been under.
And we will have episodes on that next year, because inevitably we're going to see Supreme Court cases and state Supreme Court cases litigating every aspect of this election cycle.
One thing that I will be looking at is to continue to watch how the minority responds, as well as progressive advocates. I think in our last era, maybe when it was a 5-4 majority, I think a lot of focus was on peeling off that fifth vote and how do you shape that moderate argument. I think as the court moves away from that, there were really stunning and very interesting dissents in SFFA from Sotomayor and Judge Jackson, who seemed to be sort of staking an alternative path that is not so much about winning that majority that may be unwinnable, but pointing a new direction for the law. And I think advocates as well are probably going to have to get very creative for some of these further on cases about what they want to say and how they want to say it with such a hostile climate. And is the court where we really want to have some of these fights, or are there other avenues or ways to try to push justice forward?
Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson had just, I thought, an amazing first year in terms of the questions she asked. She's an incredible writer. This is her second year. You know, if there was any sort of reservation with that first year on the court, I would expect that to not be the case this time. So I'm really excited to see how much she asserts her views in these arguments. And I agree with you. I think her and Sotomayor are writing dissents with the future in mind, knowing, hoping that their dissents get picked up when we have a different court and are used to correct history.
Absolutely. I think they have that eye to history. And definitely her first year was fabulous. I cannot wait to see what she does in their next one.
If that was her reserved, I can't wait to see her unreserved. Like, what's left?
Just more from Justice Jackson, please.
That was the notion last year of like, oh, it's a freshman justice. Like, you know, it takes everybody some time to kind of figure out how the court operates and whatnot.
And in a case where she was semi-recused. So mm-hmm. she really...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, that's a bright spot. And as this episode has made clear, we need bright spots. So we'll end on that one. Thank you all for joining me for this look ahead to the new Supreme Court term. ACS will be updating its members throughout the term with podcast episodes, programs, and email. So if you are not already an ACS member, now is a great time to join. You can go to our website, acslaw.org, and make sure to follow us on social media at ACS Law on Twitter or at American Constitution Society on Instagram and using hashtag Broken Law Podcast. Together, we'll speak truth to power about the law, whose interests it really serves, and whose it does not.